This is the Soil Sense podcast, where we believe that building healthier soils is not just a prescription, but rather a pursuit. It's a journey that requires collaboration, curiosity, and communication among farmers, researchers, agronomists, consultants, and extension. You're going to hear their stories and discover how and why they're working together to make sense out of what's happening in the soil. Hey, thanks for coming back for another episode of Soil Sense. I'm your host, Tim Hamridge. As I mentioned last episode, we were able to capture, in my opinion, some of the best information out there about soil health at the Dirt Workshop last December, thanks to some fantastic speakers and some tremendous audience engagement throughout the entire workshop. Part of this season of Soil Sense, including today's episode, will then be sharing some of that information with you. And today, we explore some of the principles behind cover crops. You're going to hear from Dr. Hans Condell, professor and extension agronomist at North Dakota State University, Dr. Matt Rourke, soil scientist from the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and Dr. Dave Franson, professor and extension soil health specialist, also at North Dakota State University. Joining them on this panel was Stefan Galens as well from the Practical Farmers of Iowa, but you're actually not going to hear from him today because I included most of his audio on the very last episode of Season 3, where I shared some dirt workshop highlights. So listen to this one and then maybe go back and re-listen to that one for the full effect here. We start today's episode with Dr. Hans Condell, who's done a lot of research on cover crops, including what cover crops are a good fit to plant after a small grain crop.
As far as what cover crop does well, I was trying to do a kind of a smorgasbord of options. And of course, the most logical one is to just use the seed that is already there, the spring wheat in this case, volunteered. So you have free seed. So that's probably the starting point of a mixture. And then if you can diversify in that mixture, you can seed other things in it. So the question always is, do you want to survive to the next season? Then you have to look at something that's winter hardy, for instance, winter rye. And I did a demonstration there with winter camelina as a newer crop. Those would survive the winter and also winter wheat. So if you just look at the fall itself, then is your objective to add some nitrogen? Peas are a great crop to put in. But as already one of the questions in the chat box was, how long do you have? And that depends, of course, when you start harvesting your small grain. But typically, if we have the middle of August till the middle of September, that's 1 month. We have a little bit of frost tolerance in some of the crops, like some of the brassicas, some of the peas. Then we can extend the growing season up to maybe October. So if you want to have something that penetrates the soil more, you can maybe have some radishes. So it really always goes back to what is your main objective. And some growers may even want to graze it. So then maybe you add some of the legumes for some additional protein. So there is not a one cocktail or one species that does best. It depends really on the wishes of the producer, but there are many opportunities.
Well, as you heard him say, there's a lot of different approaches one can take to cover crops, and we're going to explore several of those here today. But certainly one consideration when choosing a cover crop is the potential for disease and pest transfer from one season to the next.
Well, if you think about the cereals, there could potentially be a bridge between, the spring wheat, the rye being green, and then going for a next grain plot. Now, when we think about the other issues, I'm thinking more about diseases that we have to be considering. For instance, with the brassicas, if you have those in a canola system, that is a no-no because we can have a club root in the brassicas. So if you have a canola and a brassica in that rotation, that could potentially increase those situations. So that is, also kind of a bridge from one disease to the next one. So the other thing that came to mind is not a disease, but it's actually something maybe good. If you plant green, in our northern region, we have a lot of iron chlorosis. And if you plant soybeans into a green crop, the green crop probably has taken out a little bit more nitrates and therefore is probably going to benefit the soybean. So there is an indirect effect of the nitrate taken up by the green crop for soybeans. So those are a couple things that quickly come to mind.
So we started off here today talking about planting cover crops after a small grain crop. But what about trying to get a cover crop planted after soybeans?
Yeah, so that is always the question. Can you establish still a cover crop after a soybean crop? So then you kind of talk about relay cropping. So we did a couple of experiments at timing, but also row spacing and the maturity of the soybean. So let me just kind of summarize that it can be done probably broadcasting seed at the time when, you know, the lower leaves of the soybean start to senesce, yellowing. So we are transitioning from a full canopy to an opening of the canopy. So that would be possible, but because our, you know, season is kind of pushing the limits, often that takes place maybe in September. So we are kind of late in that opportunity. So the other question then is, oh, well, what if you compare, you know, row spacing? So if you go with 12-inch row spacing versus 24, 24 would be a more open canopy. Can you, you know, go in a little earlier? Well, you can go in a little bit earlier, but you're giving up some yield potential if you have wider rows than narrow rows. So if you look at economics, so that choice is, you know, if your planter is set up for wider rows, you know, that is a benefit. And then the question was, oh, if you go with an earlier maturing soybean, will that help? Because they will start to senesce quicker and then you have more time on the clock. And yes, you will get more biomass. And yes, the next spring there is more biomass. But the yield of the earlier maturing was, you know, quite a bit lower than one that is kind of adapted to the maturity of a region. So we're giving up some bushels just by the maturity selection. So in other words, it can be done. And then probably you look at the end of the season, you know, when we start to senesce yellowing of the beans on the bottom, if the canopy starts to open, that's probably the best. And, you know, we still have some work to do, but the time is very short and the amount of biomass that we actually produce then in the fall is very limited.
Well, no matter where cover crops might be fitting into your rotation, one question a lot of people have is which cover crop species should they use in their mix? And how diverse does that mix need to be?
Yeah, so I'm kind of thinking about it as a you know, mimicking of nature. And if you look at most of the area in the northern part of the U.S. was prairie, right? And if you look at the prairie landscape, it was very diverse. So there's nothing against diversity. So I think the question remains then, okay, cost, what can you afford and what are the cheaper ones? Well, the cheapest one would be the volunteer that is already growing. And then the grains are kind of cheap. And then this morning, one of the, you know, panel members or questioners was saying, what about flax or some grass seeds? So you can have a quite a mixture. But then if your objective is to put nitrogen, yes, you have to put some legumes in it. But if you put legumes in a mix, that means that there's only a percentage of your field that has a legume. So if you go back to the early discussion that nitrogen is related to the total biomass, if it is just a small percentage of your cover percent, then you're not going to add that much nitrogen. If you talk about deep-rooted radishes, you know, those have a special function. But I would say my experience is if you put a cocktail together and you put the same cocktail on two different fields, three different fields, three different seasons, at the end, and you evaluate what is growing there, you will come to the conclusion that every time the combination of which plants are dominant will be different. So my take on it is let the plants decide which one is the best environment and just have a mixture available as long as it is cheap enough so that it doesn't cost too much.
Okay, one last scenario here to throw at Hans. We talked about planting cover crops after a small grain, but what about the opposite, meaning the idea of planting small grains green into a cover crop?
So you're talking about having a cover crop and then going into it with a small grain. Yeah. I don't know if that is done. What I did do is I had cover crops growing and then I terminated them just at the time of planting spring wheat. And what we saw in that case is that if the rye was a little bit aggressive growing in the spring, we actually had a negative effect on the wheat yield. So that was then the one that could be planted green. So if I would have let it go further, it would have been disastrous for the spring wheat. So, you know, depending on what crop you use, if it was like camelina, which is a different crop, you might be able to plant green, but I don't think anybody has really looked at that.
Okay, thank you to Hans. And speaking of small grains, Dr. Matt Rourke has done some work with interseeding cover crops into small grains. And so this is probably a good point to transition things over to Matt.
So for clovers and small grains, I really like the red clover. Red clover knows its role. So you can get it going in the understory and it doesn't try to overachieve. And that kind of holds true for any sort of interseeding into other crops as well. Well, others, I keep trying to grow. No, you know, red clover just gets going and hangs out. What we like to do is we have this probably like to frost seed where we go in March, maybe early April. The snow's off the ground, but some dry conditions, a little bit of cracking in that soil surface. Then we're going to broadcast the seed and hopefully use that little cracking to get some good seed soil contact. Then we've had really good success year after year in getting good establishment. And then by the time we take that wheat off, we've got that red clover ready to go. The other value of this that we like is then we can grow so much biomass in the fall that we actually just go ahead and terminate the red clover at the end, like in early October. We've grown so much nitrogen that we don't need to worry about letting it grow into the spring. We don't need to be too greedy, so we can terminate it and we get these really great responses in terms of nitrogen supply to that next corn crop. So that's been a real great success. Of course, the trick is like getting out there and getting that right timing down of the application. So that's really been our biggest success. Although outside of red clover, I haven't tested any other interseeded legumes into small grains.
Staying on this concept of terminating the cover crop in the fall once you've got enough biomass, how do you know when to do this? Matt describes the approach, and then you're going to hear a follow-up question in here from Dr. Abby Wick, who moderated this panel.
And so that's the trick with the legumes, and we need to plant them early so you can get the biomass. So to me, the legumes are just strictly a biomass game once you can produce enough biomass. Now, we've played around with red clover, and that'll survive the winters. So if you want to try to grow a little more nitrogen into the spring, but we've also had good success with like the crimson clovers. I heard that being discussed earlier today. Also Bursine clover, things that are winter kill in our northern climate, so you don't have to manage it again. I think that's the nice thing. Once you get enough biomass, I guess as long as there's enough biomass and that residue starts to decompose, it decomposes quickly. So the more biomass you have, the more nitrogen release you have. So that to me is the trick. So your second question, right, was related to how much total biomass, like with that rye, gets out of control, right?
Yeah. You plant rye, you have a long fall, you get a ton of biomass, you're freaking out going into the spring because there's so much there. And what does that mean for managing?
That's really, once we hit that, you know, one ton threshold of biomass, to us, that's the tipping point of, oh, that's when bad things can start to happen. So one thing is you're taking up a lot of biomass. Two, you're planting, sometimes we see some, if it's corn following that rye, we see some yield suppression. So we can think about how much can you adapt. One is if you see there's that much biomass going on in the fall, should you just try to go out and terminate in the fall and not have that coverage in the spring? That's for people to decide if they want that spring coverage. You know, a lot of places in Wisconsin, that's actually their goal. They want to have that spring coverage for those spring rains, especially for something found like a corn silage or any crop where there's not a lot of residue on the cover in the spring. So that'd be one of the trade-offs. Two is, can you harvest it? Can you take it as another silage crop? There's some potential opportunities with winter rye for that. Otherwise, the goal is those have to be your priority fields and try to get out and get those terminated as soon as you possibly can. Move your nitrogen fertilizer application up a little bit, perhaps. Make sure you've got nitrogen in your starter setup. But those can be those scenarios where bad things can happen, I suppose, in terms of agronomics. Now, the good news is you've grown a lot of carbon. It's returned if you're trying to do those soil building practices. There's a benefit if you're using it for water quality. But then we can grow too much and then it kind of tips. We're like, maybe on the agronomic side, we see some negative things.
Now, with something like interseeding, it's hardly ever an exact and predictable experience. Matt was asked for his tips and advice on making interseeding work.
So interseeding is tricky. That's my answer. No.
Perfect.
There's been a lot of experimental work, like will it grow? Anything will grow for a certain amount of time. And this gets back to, you know, Hans's point of like, what's the goal here? And so we've struggled with getting good success and establishment of grass crops interseeded into corn. My angle has been like these legumes are great because they'll supply nitrogen. And if you have, so in Wisconsin, we do have a fair amount of land that's corn into corn. So if we can grow some legumes in that corn phase, and then maybe it could supply nitrogen in that next phase. But again, it's that same trick where the red clover establishes, it always establishes well. It tends to establish a little bit better than the other ones, and it'll survive, right? And so after the corn harvest, if there's a little bit of growth at the end of the season, maybe there is, maybe there isn't, then it'll put on a little bit of biomass. But the trick with that, though, it's not enough. So we have to let it grow into the spring to get enough biomass to get the benefit. And then it just becomes, what are the weather conditions in the spring? So we've had some years with great success and we grew a fair amount of biomass and it supplied some nitrogen, but other years where it never really put on, it never really thickened up, never really got a lot of biomass to supply that nitrogen. So we're still at the mercy of the weather patterns, especially in the spring.
One aspect of panels like this that actually worked really well in a virtual environment is that the panelists were able to respond to participants' questions in real time. In this case, some of the attendees in the chat were voicing concerns that red clover might not work in their area.
There's a lot of comments about clover, and maybe probably more local information is needed in North Dakota related to red clover. A lot of comments about maybe not catching, doesn't overwinter very well. So what are the other options outside of red clover? Certainly red clover has been one of the more popular ones, but playing around with the legumes, I think is probably the more perhaps short-term rewarding cover crop. If we can figure out how to get the legumes to grow in these crop rotations and supply some nitrogen, but maybe it's not red clover. Maybe it is crimson clover. Maybe it's perseme clover. Maybe there's some other popular clovers for the western side of the state. So what gets me the most excited about evaluating cover crops is trying to get the use of legumes in rotation, because it does have that short-term economic benefit of supplying some nitrogen. So do we have that dialed in? Not quite necessarily, you know, in all the regions. And if I could just make one more comment, there was a lot of comments about, well, do you get the nitrogen back with these grass cover crops? And Dr. Franzen answered a question on that. And the trick is, if you can keep growing these grasses year after year after year, the nitrogen has to go somewhere, right? So assuming that it's not just slowly leaching out over time, so you're going to have that potential buildup of organic matter in soil, but it's a long-term game. And then in a perfect world, we'd also be building up these organic nitrogen pools. And the problem that we're having right now, or the maybe it's not necessarily a problem, but the big research area that we're trying to, a lot of people are working on, is what's that best measurement? Maybe it's not the entire soil organic matter measured through loss on ignition. Maybe it's a pool of organic carbon or nitrogen that'll help us know that we've built up these levels in soils, and maybe there'd be an opportunity to cut back on nitrogen fertilization. So right now we don't have anything ready for prime time, but ultimately that would be some of the thought process of when would you get the nitrogen back. With the grasses, it's probably going to be many, many years in the future, but it's a long-term game for soil improvement. So.
Staying on the topic of red clover here for just a minute, Dr. Dave Franzen weighed in with some historical context on making it work in North Dakota.
Yeah, so I wasn't going to talk about this, but I'm going to talk about this. So it's really interesting that people have had really bad luck with red clover here in the state, and it's surprised me a little bit. Because back in 1910, around the Hillsborough area, there's about a 2,000-acre plus farm, which is huge back in the day, that all they did was produce red clover seed. And they sold it through the whole region. And then before too long, alfalfa came back and it became king. And so nobody grows it anymore. But I don't think it's like nobody grows it. I think, back in the certified crop and certified seed publication, that there are still one or two red clover people around. So maybe the reason red clover isn't very winter hardy around here is we're buying seed from Arkansas or someplace. So if we were buying seed from somebody up here that actually raised North Dakota seed, that maybe it actually would do something. So I just want to throw that out, that in the past, red clover was king in North Dakota.
Well, now to step back more generally, we asked Dr. Franzen if he could talk a little bit more about his experience observing the nitrogen dynamics of cover crops after a small grain.
So some of the sites that we work with have just been the cereal, the volunteer, like Hans is saying, or maybe seeded rye if, again, you wanted it to overwinter, and then a radish. And then at another location, we did whatever the farmer wanted to do. In the first year, it was bio-strip till. with field peas and rows, and then radish and a little bit of turnip and a little bit of flax, and then the volunteer winter wheat. It was a long fall. He put these in around August 10th, and it really didn't freeze until end of November. So we had, 5,000 pounds of biomass, dry biomass, and the peas were just about mature. And that's the year that I really thought that if we were going to get some nitrogen release, that would be it. But maybe because the following season was kind of dry, the crop grew well, but we just didn't get any nitrogen release at all. In another year, we had, in the same area, we had biostrip till with fava bean as legume instead of the field pea, and we had a little bit shorter fall. But again, the next year, we had a little bit of contribution on nitrogen, but not near as much as what we thought we would. So if you're in a mix, it's really hard to predict what you're going to do. I think other researchers, I think Matt Rourke might have some information about what they might expect if there's a pure legume in there, and that's a lot different. But I think, you know, some people think that in order to get any kind of cycling, you need to have at least a month of growth, and I'm not sure that that's enough, especially with the nitrate that's usually in our soils. All the legumes are going to do in that 30-day period is just drain the nitrate that's in the soil. They're really not going to contribute anything themselves with the symbiotic nitrogen fixation. So I think you have to have more than that, and that's a tough sell in the Northern Valley, because if you get your small grains crop out and maybe the third week of August, trying to cross your fingers and not have a frost until October 1st is pretty tough. So I know we wouldn't have done it this year.
Now, what about those that are in more of an arid region? How can they use cover crops without giving up too much of their precious moisture?
So we had a really dry year in 2019, even here in the East. And you know, I fully understand the value of water in the West. I mean, there's from time to time, there's a really wet year, but that's really not the nature of anything west of Carrington. So in this really dry year, we had the two sites that are in our big cover crop research. One site was in a long-term no-till field at Tilmoni's. And, you know, you've seen, I think, Anthony's work before on the soil sense. And it was just as dry there as it was in the transitional no-till site up at the Share Farm up north by New Rockford, Northwood, in that area. So you would think that they would respond the same, but I think because of Anthony's mulch or groundwater, the cover crops were sustained, and we had some pretty nice yields at Valley City after our barley. But up north, it was really poor establishment. It was on a landscape, and in the higher landscapes where it was drier, the take of the cover crops was a lot less germination. When it got down into the little darker soils, then the germination was better, but the biomass was still, 25% of what it was at Valley City. We've also had drier years in some of our studies, and when we had camelina at Gardner in that valley soil, the really high clay soil, you would think that it would survive some water stress, but it really put some stress on some soybeans growing that year. If I was a farmer and I had a spring like that and saw what the camelina was doing to the dryness of the soil, I would have terminated it earlier rather than later. I think just being aware and knowing that you got to manage the thing instead of just let it grow until you plant, you have to keep your eyes open and use some common sense when you have cover crops in the West.
He mentioned Anthony Tilimoni's work. You can learn more about that back in episodes 3 and 4 of season 1 of Soil Sense. We also asked Dr. Franson to add on to the interseeding conversation, what he's seen work and not work in his research with interseeding.
So in our rotations in our work, we had soybeans after corn, and so the nitrogen benefit really wasn't a big deal. But the idea was to just get some kind of growth after corn for people that wanted some kind of served two purposes. One is a catch crop for the nitrogen that might be left over after the corn, and the other for just building up organic matter, speeding the transition to what we would call full-blown real-time no-till. So In almost every year, we used to, in your seeder that actually put the seed in the ground, and almost all the years we were pretty successful doing that. And we had a couple of years that were pretty dry, and I was worried about it. And the first time that it happened, it was a really dry summer. And so I really expected that where we had the cover crop rye and the radish that we would have a yield decline, and we didn't see even a whiff of it. And so I think what's happening, and we're still working on trying to nail down if this is what's happening or not, but the rye and the radish, when you're interseeding, and we did it, what, V6 to V8, somewhere in that time frame, it's small, not really competitive, it's kind of ferny leaf. And so I think whenever there's a dew, the cover crop is acting like a dew catcher. So I think that's happening. We're yet to prove it, but it makes sense to me. You would think that something that is alive and growing during a dry year would hold back the corn yields, and it just doesn't seem to do that. So there has to be something going into the system that's offsetting the use of the cover crops, because they're not growing in no water. They're using some water, not very much, but when it's dry, anything is something.
One question that comes up often in soil health conversations is, how do you know if you're on the right track? I thought Dr. Franson had a creative way of assessing in-field if farmers are getting the nitrogen benefit they think they're getting from their cover crop program.
Yeah, so we have a bunch of growers and people from quite a wide area right now. And so even if it was just in the state and the region, I would recommend this. So let's say that you have a pretty good cover crop growth. Maybe it includes some legumes or mostly legumes, and you really think that you're going to get some nitrogen benefit the next year. And let's say that your normal fertilizer rate would be maybe 150 pounds of N pre-plant for whatever crop you're going to grow, and you think you're going to get maybe 40 pounds of N benefit from that cover crop. Well, go ahead, when you put your base rate of N down, go ahead and put that 110 pounds of N on. But then in the strip, about the width of an applicator, maybe 100 feet long or something, someplace where you can watch it, put that extra 40 pounds on, put that 150 pounds on. And if you're going by there early in the season and it looks just as green on the strip as it does in the rest of the field, then you've made the right choice and, you know, you can stop worrying about it. But if that strip is greener than the 110 you put on the rest, and that means that you overestimated how much N you're going to get from that cover crop, and you need to go in and supplement it.
Well, thank you so very much to Dr. Hans Condell, Dr. Matt Rourke, and Dr. Dave Franson for this in-depth panel discussion on cover crops, research, and strategy. Be sure to also check out the NDSU Soil Health YouTube channel to see videos profiling some of the work you just heard about. Thanks as well to our sponsors, the North Dakota Corn Council, the North Dakota Wheat Commission, the North Dakota Barley Council, and the North Harvest Dry Bean Association. If you're getting value from this podcast, please leave us a rating and review on iTunes or wherever you listen to the show, and share your favorite episode on Twitter with the hashtag SoilSense. Thanks so much. We'll be back next week.